This week, we learned that Donald Trump's campaign is in dire financial and organizational straits. So what's his game plan? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we're joined by political analysts Dennis Goldberg of Drake University and Dave Anderson of Iowa State University. I'll ask them just how dire Trump's situation is less than a month before the Republican convention. Also, what now after the U.S. Senate rejects four measures restricting gun sales following last week's mass shooting? And Iowa Congressman Steve King tries to stop Harriet Tubman from appearing on the $20 bill. Join us for this and plenty more on this Politics Day. First, this hour's news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday upon us once again. So glad to have with us Dennis Goldberg, Department Chair, Professor of Political Science. Also, Flansburg Fellow at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake University. Dennis, welcome aboard.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Dave Anderson with us as well, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University in Ames. Dave, welcome back to you.
Thanks for having me.
I want to dedicate the first half hour, focus mostly on gun legislation or lack of gun legislation by the Congress. And then later in the hour, we'll look at the 2016 campaign as it heats up in earnest. And Hillary Clinton warning that Trump's economic policies would cause a global recession. Trump slamming what he called failed policies and bad judgment of crooked Hillary Clinton. We'll get into that a little bit later in the hour. But as I said, gentlemen, let's first focus on the congressional response to that latest mass shooting last week in Orlando. Democrats, we heard in the top of the hour in our news within the last couple of hours, beginning a staging a sit-in on the House floor to push for action on gun control. More than two dozen Democrats participating in this sit-in, literally sitting in on the floor shortly before noon in D.C. time, cross-legged on the floor, some of them. Representative John Lewis of Georgia, he's the veteran lawmaker who was brutally beaten by police in the Civil Rights March on Selma, began the sit-in with a speech on the floor where he was surrounded by dozens of his colleagues. Here's a bit of that.
For months, even for years, through several sessions of Congress, I wondered, what would bring this body to take action? What would finally make Congress do what is right, what is just, what the people of this country have been demanding, and what is long overdue? We have lost hundreds and thousands of innocent people to gun violence. Tiny little children, babies, students, and teachers, mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers, daughters and sons, friends and neighbors. And what has this body done?
Representative John Lewis of Georgia, just minutes ago, a sit-in being staged on the U.S. House floor. And we want to reach out to you. You've been following the news this week, Iowa Public Radio listeners. So how do you feel about congressional response to the latest mass shooting? What specific steps do you think Congress should take? We want to talk about some of the plans that were launched this week and blocked. Let's talk about it with our analysts, Dave Anderson and Dennis Goldberg. Monday, the U.S. Senate blocked plans to curb guns. In largely party-line votes, senators rejecting one proposal from each side to keep extremists from acquiring guns. Second, shoring up the government's system of required background checks for many firearms purchases. Iowa's Charles Grassley, also Joni Ernst, our senators, both rejecting two proposals from Democrats, supporting two from Republicans, including an amendment sponsored by Senator Grassley, which would have increased money for the background check system. Also revamping language prohibiting some people with mental health issues from buying a gun, which Democrats claim would reduce current protections. Let's listen to our freshman senator here in Iowa, Joni Ernst, on Des Moines Channel 13 News yesterday, talking about her concern over a Democratic proposal to bar all gun sales to individuals on this terror watch list?
It needs to go through a court of law, not just random people saying, hey, I don't think this person should have a weapon, so let's just put their name on a list. We can't do that. We can't start taking away rights. As a government, we should not be taking away rights.
Okay. Dennis, let me go to you. Characterize what's been happening this week in terms of the gun legislation, the politics happening in our U.S. Congress.
Yeah, there are two sides of or ways of looking at this. One is in terms of policy. You know, what actually will lessen the incidence of gun violence? I read the other day that since Orlando, 270 people have been killed by guns in the U.S. So the question is, what do you do about that? And that's always an issue. The politics of it, though, is what you're referring to. And the gun control and the Second Amendment have become hot-button social issues. It's almost a cultural thing. And you have passionate supporters and opponents around the issue of gun control. Republicans have been the party who want to err on the side of protecting people's right to own guns in terms of the Second Amendment. Democrats are people who want to err on the side of protecting the public and limiting the right to own firearms. Now, what Senator Ernst is suggesting there, of course, when you suggest that this issue of using people's position on the no-fly list to forbid them the right to have a gun, when she says take that to a court, that, of course, undermines the whole possibility of doing anything, which may be the good policy issue. I don't know. I'm not taking a position there. Because then you're talking about a case-by-case legal procedure. Mm-hmm. There's a saying among lawyers I read long ago that the nearest we can get to any experience of eternity on this earth is being involved in a lawsuit.
Right. Dave Anderson, give us your view on this and why this election year is complicating matters.
Well, I think the election year is why we're talking about this issue. Gun rights and the ability for government to kind of prevent people from buying firearms is a long simmering debate in America. It's always something that's kind of under the radar, if not slightly above the radar. But in an election year, both parties want to talk about it because it energizes voters. The Republican Party knows that if they can convince their voters, their supporters, that the Democrats are coming to get their guns, it gets Republican voters out to the polls. And Democrats want to convince their supporters that if they go out and vote, we'll finally see some serious gun restrictions in this country.
I believe, though, and Dave, correct me if I'm wrong, if you remember better, I think there was a claim that in 2000, the gun control issue cost Vice President Gore the state of West Virginia. Democrats, at least since then, have tended, quite a lot of them at the national level, have shied away from opening that can of worms, or that IED, if you will, given their political fortunes. It's interesting that Democrats now seem to want to make it an issue and use it for the same kinds of political reasons that Republicans have done for quite some time.
Mm-hmm. And
sure. I'll answer that if I can. I think you're totally right. Al Gore lost West Virginia in 2000. I think he got hurt around the country on the gun control issue. And this stemmed from a series of gun bills that came out in the 90s on the state and federal level that really just were used to pummel Democrats across the country. And I think what we're seeing now is that Democrats are still afraid to really propose strong gun legislation. The proposals that are being talked about in Congress right now are very, very, very limited, mainly trying to limit the ability of somebody on a terror watch list to buy a firearm, which is about the slimmest form of gun restriction that I can think of.
Lawmakers certainly looking at polls and how they've changed over the years since Al Gore ran for president. Support for gun control measures increased by 9 percentage points, according to a new CNN ORC poll that was released this Monday, finding 55% of Americans in favor of stricter gun laws, 42% opposed. According to the poll, the highest level of support since that was taken in 2013, just a month after the Sandy Hook Elementary shooting in Connecticut. But listen to these, and you were talking about the simplest of measures, Dave. Listen to this huge support we have when we talk about specific policy steps. According to this poll, 92% of respondents favoring expanded background checks, 87 supporting prohibiting convicted felons or people with mental health problems from buying guns. 85% in support of banning people on the terror watch list or on the no-fly list from buying guns. So it would seem, would it not, that this has perhaps changed? Are the Democrats in safe territory, Hillary Clinton, in calling for gun restrictions?
I don't really think so. And it's because vast majorities of the public may want stronger gun restrictions, but very few of those people are going to go out and cast their vote on that issue.
Mm-hmm. It's not going to be a deciding issue for many voters. Dennis, you agree?
Well, it's not symmetrical. I mean, one of the exactly. things we have to remember is the very structure and operation of Congress, particularly the committee system and the way we choose our representatives on essentially a local level, means, and people remember their civics, that it's possible for a highly organized, intensely motivated minority to defeat the will of a less highly organized and less intensely motivated majority. And when I say it's not symmetrical, it's that the people who don't want and fear what they take to be threats to gun ownership and gun rights, they're more organized and intense than the people who argue that that kind of ownership is a threat to peace and good order.
Join our conversation as we talk on Politics Day, at least in the first part of the program. We're talking about gun legislation. Congress's response or lack of response to the latest mass shooting last week. What specific steps do you think Congress should take? How do you feel about Congress's response? It's inaction. James is with us in Des Moines. He dialed 1-866-780-9100. Hello, James. Welcome to the program.
Hello. There's no response. That's the problem. And it's intuitively obvious to the most casual observer that people are getting guns who should not have that ability to get them. If you can't buy a fly, you shouldn't be able to buy. But the one thing that will help this issue, as well as many more, is overturning Citizens United and getting money out of federal elections.
Mm-hmm. You think the money is having a big say in how these congressional leaders feel about gun control?
Not just gun control, but everything. You know, if you go out and you look at the polls that they're taking about hot button issues that face this country right now, from gun control to same-sex marriage, to the peace movement, to foreign intervention, all of those issues, there is a public sentiment about every one of them in the majority that's not being represented. And so it's money and politics that drives those decisions. And I'd be interested to hear what your experts have to say about there's one thing that we can do to help a whole number, a panoply of issues that would make our lives better without taking away our rights as guaranteed in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights.
James in Des Moines, thank you very much. We'll get response. Let's go to Dave Anderson. What are your thoughts on James's comments there, Dave?
Well, I think James is right. It's money in politics that really is kind of behind a lot of these issues. The real difficulty, though, is how do you solve the problem? Not only Citizens United, but we have a longstanding kind of history in the United States of allowing private people to give money to support issues they care about. And even if we go to a pre-Citizen United period, that doesn't go away. I think the best example of the NRA being involved in taking out a politician that I'm aware of is in 1993 when they went after Jim Florio, the then governor of New Jersey. And they knew that gun rights was not a big issue in New Jersey, but Jim Florio had passed a anti-gun bill that went on to be the model for the federal bill. And they poured money into New Jersey, not in gun rights legislation, but in every other issue where people opposed Jim Florio. And he got absolutely destroyed in that election.
So, Dave, trace this, perhaps to look at the partisan roots of this debate. How has it evolved? There at least used to be some common ground on gun legislation. Think of the Brady Bill in the aftermath of the attempted assassination of President Reagan, right?
Sure.
Democrats, Republicans on board, right?
Absolutely. Well, Congress and politics in general used to be able to discuss issues more openly and agree that we recognized common problems and that we could come together and compromise for solutions. But the current political atmosphere is way too polarized for that right now. Neither side wants to compromise.
I would add that money is always an issue. However, The NRA was the paradigm case for one of the most effective interest and lobbying groups in the country well before Citizens United came along. So they were doing their thing even before Citizens United, therefore repealing Citizens United or overturning it, I don't think would undermine the National Rifle Association. And second, increasingly, you know, there are five correlates of a likely Republican vote: older, white, male, rural, Southern. Older, white, male, rural, Southern. And particularly people in more rural and small town areas in the Midwest and especially the South, that's where you find more of the gun culture. Democrats are more the party of big cities now, and there's certainly gun issues in big cities. Just look at Chicago. But the gun rights aspect you see located much more in the areas that are represented by Republicans nowadays.
Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Dave Anderson of Iowa State University on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's go back to our calls. Call from out of state from Chris in Cincinnati in Ohio. Another caller from another swing state, Ohio, which will be very important in this upcoming election. Glad you're listening to Iowa Public Radio. Chris, what's on your mind in this debate?
Well, thank you. Actually, I'm in Des Moines today, so that's why I'm here.
Oh, but you're originally from Cincinnati.
I'm
you
from
live
Cincinnati.
There. All right.
And I will be voting in Ohio, yes.
Excellent.
And I will be voting against our current senator because of his gun, he's for gun controls as a Republican. And we've always voted Republican, and we can't do it anymore. We just don't understand, why do they continue to call it gun control and not just common sense gun legislation? I mean, I think the gun control, everyone's like, oh no, they're going to take our guns.
Mm-hmm. Where was the turning point for you and your husband, Chris, when you say you can't do it and you can't support this position anymore? Was there a moment? Was there one of these mass shootings that had you and your husband?
Sandy Hook.
Yep.
Yes. And also, the other thing is, we own some land down in Kentucky, and as my husband was going down there, he saw on the side of the road tables full of guns, people milling around, picking out their guns. There's clearly no background checks there. Things like that, and at guns, you know, gun shows. And
gun show loophole, yes, talked about often.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Just those kind of things are, it doesn't make any sense. He's a Marine. We own guns. We're not afraid that they're going to take our guns.
Okay. Chris, visiting from Cincinnati, mm-hmm. Ohio, in Iowa. Enjoy your stay, Chris. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think the people that support gun rights, though, would argue, and I've seen some data on this that seems to be reliable. The first is that the vast majority of killings, death by gunshot, is suicide. And that of those killings that are a homicide in some sort, it's very rarely the case that it's an assault weapon or a semi-automatic or an AR-15 or those sorts of things. And so they will make the point that the vast majority of gun owners are law-abiding and use them for target practice, use them for self-defense, in the sense if you're in a house out on a farm somewhere, you know, when the corn gets high, people may not be able to see that house from the road. And I think they'll say then they need a shotgun or something like that in case of a potential home invasion. So I think that's the argument made on that side.
And I heard the other argument made just the other day, Dennis, that someone says, oh, well, why do you need the assault rifles, the AR-15? Well, if my house is invaded by legal people carrying AR-15s, I don't want to have a handgun. I want to have an AR-15, too. So it's an escalation.
Oh, it absolutely is. One of the problems is, though, that a lot of gun rights people take the Second Amendment as absolute in some sense. And none of the rights we have are absolute. The question is always, if it's a fundamental right, as the court rightly or wrongly said the Second Amendment is for individuals to own handguns, the government has to demonstrate that it has a compelling reason for overturning or infringing upon that right. And gun rights people want to say that's very rarely the case. Mm-hmm. The people that favor gun control want to say that it's quite often the case.
Sarah is with us in Mount Vernon. Thanks for dialing 1-866-780-9100. Sarah, what do you want to put into this conversation?
Well, I was listening to the calls, I looked up the leading 25 causes of death. in this country, which still is heart disease, cancer, stroke, and then land vehicle accidents and intentional self-harm are the top five. And I'm curious, but when I think about gun control in the terms of your conversation this morning, it's more like you're talking about behavior control, not gun control. You're trying to control the behaviors of people and whatever vehicle they choose to exert their violence doesn't really seem to have much to do with their behavior. And then I wonder why there is such a strong reaction to gun violence and not to these other causes of death that cause us to be talking about greater legislation to control people's behavior when we know we could have control over heart disease and stroke with, mm-hmm. with stronger laws about people's behaviors.
Interesting perspective, Sarah in Mount Vernon.
And I'll take my answer offline.
Okay, any reaction perhaps from from you, Dave? Yeah.
Sure. Well, I would say all of the leading causes of death are typically the source of a lot of federal scrutiny. We spend billions of dollars, federal research dollars, every year investigating heart disease and cancer, car accidents, strokes. We invest lots and lots of money to try to figure out how to prevent these things. Gun violence is one thing that we are congressionally barred from spending federal dollars to investigate. Almost every other major source of death in America, we invest a lot of money to try to figure out how we can decrease that. But Congress passed a law a while ago saying that we're not allowed to do that for guns because they are protected by the Second Amendment, which is frustrating for a lot of people.
The gun rights people for years have said, and there's a phrase everybody's heard of, guns don't kill people, people kill people. That's true, but you know the difficulty is the people with guns kill people a lot more easily than using something else. You never hear of a drive-by knifing right. or a drive-by poisoning.
And in other countries, you hear of people running amok with a machete or something.
Right.
They don't kill 50 people.
That's right. And also, if you could say that you have swift and sure punishment for deterrence, well, that doesn't deal with the person who takes the gun and is willing to die in the act. The deterrent possibility of prison doesn't work in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Today, the U.S. Senate is likely to pass a Republican-backed proposal to expand the FBI's secretive surveillance powers. It's a spying bill that is a Republican response to the push for gun control measures. Legislation that would broaden the type of telephone and internet records the FBI would request from companies like Verizon without a warrant. Now, interestingly, this is a bill which the Obama administration has sought for years. Dave, what do you think of this? A sign that the Republicans want to be at least seen as doing something to fight domestic terrorism. It's not gun control, but they're putting it in those terms.
Sure, and that's exactly what they're trying to do, is say that they are responding to the Orlando massacre, and they're going to propose what they view as more successful legislation. They're going to deal with the issue not by taking away guns or restricting access to guns, but by putting the people who are more at risk of committing terrorism under closer scrutiny by the government.
Okay, we'll continue our conversation after a short break. It's Politics Day here on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Ben Kiefer with Dave Anderson of Iowa State University, Dennis Goldford of Drake University. We'd like to have you join our conversation. We're going to dovetail into talking about 2016 politics more generally. And now that the general election battles have begun, wow, have they ever, words from the presumptive nominees, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. We'll play a few of those coming up in just a moment. Trump warning that the economic policies that Clinton warning that the Trump's economic policies would cause a global recession. And also Hillary Clinton firing back. We'll hear their words when we return. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, Politics Wednesday. Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Dave Anderson of Iowa State University. We hope you'll join our conversation. When you feel the need to jump in, jot this down, this number down, put it on your refrigerator. How about that as a nice old-fashioned reminder? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. We talked a lot about the lack of gun legislation, Congress struggling with responses to the latest mass shooting in Orlando last week. We want to concentrate more this half hour on the 2016 race, the latest news out there. Dennis and Dave, let's have you respond to this. Certainly not calming the nerves of any Republican leaders, the news of the last few days. Donald Trump disclosing that his campaign finished May with little more than $1 million in the bank. Compared to that, Hillary Clinton reporting having over $42 million. Now, we have to remember, Trump swept through the primaries, destroyed his opponents in primaries and caucuses with a bare-bones campaign staff and a budget funded largely out of his own bank account. Now, though, we've got the general election. He has only a shadow of the financial and political infrastructure that she has amassed. Dave, you first. How dire is Trump's situation with these new numbers?
Well, I don't think it's as dire as it's being made out to be right now. There's still lots of time left. And Trump has, if nothing else, been extremely innovative in how he runs his campaign. He has admittedly done terribly in raising money. But I think what he's going to argue is that he doesn't think he needs that much money. And he also thinks he has the ability to raise it rapidly if he needs to. At one point, he said he was going to invest $600 million of his own money. I don't think anyone really expects that at this point. But he and a few of his close friends can probably write $100 million checks. And that's really the pace that we expect to see in the coming months. We expect to see the candidates raising about $100 million per month. When you can turn to your own pocketbook and take that out, it helps the situation.
Mm-hmm. Not so dire as portrayed in the media, Dennis. You agree?
I agree. I mean, one of the factors, of course, is that if this estimate's valid, when television, particularly cable, gives you $2 billion worth of free airtime, you don't have to raise a lot of money otherwise. But at the same time, number one, it's early. Number two, Trump dealt with, his opponents divided the anti-Trump vote, and to some extent they wanted to cruise along in his wake, as, no pun intended, Ted Cruz did, swim along in his wake, hoping to inherit his supporters without going after Trump. So everybody did everything against each other and left Trump alone, thinking he'd implode on his own, which he didn't. And number three, the problem for Trump, I think, is that he's campaigned so far as if campaigning and running for election were simply performance art. And to some extent, that works in the primaries. I think 30 million people voted in the Republican primaries, but roughly 130 million are going to vote in November. And what works for 30 million people probably won't work for 130 million people. And you need the kind of organizational infrastructure to identify and turn out your vote that the Obama people perfected and the Cruz people were working on. And Hillary Clinton has under control now. The question is whether Trump can finesse that.
Can he build up an infrastructure? Look at the difference here. Trump having about 70 staff nationwide compared to 700 for Hillary Clinton. Really no campaign offices to speak of for Trump on the order that Clinton has them. He's not put out a single television ad in a general election.
Hillary Clinton was the prohibitive favorite in 2008, and look what happened.
Okay.
So, I always say a week's a long time in politics.
What about this idea? We've been hearing reports about Donald Trump's presidential campaign steering more than $6 million to various Trump companies over the last year. So he's financing it, but it's going to finance his company's services to his own campaign. It's within federal campaign finance boundaries. What do you think of this, Dave? If you were a donor, you'd say, oh, wouldn't you? I mean, there are reports that donors are saying, I give to a man so that he can invest it in his own companies.
There are a lot of questions about whether Republican donors, and in particular the major Republican donors, are comfortable with giving money to Trump when he really has not put in a lot of his own money yet. I think Mitt Romney put in more. And there's a question of how he's going to spend it. Donald Trump had a quote from several years ago where he said when he ran for president, he thought he would be the first person to turn a profit off of it, indicating that he was looking to kind of get his companies in the mix, and that if you're going to spend $10 million in advertising, why not hire your own company and make a dime off it? That may be good business sense, but it's questionable to people who are giving you the money. And I think that's going to become a story probably for the next week or two.
Mm-hmm. Trump and Clinton on the attack against each other in earnest. Let's listen to some of their quotes, some of their audio from the past few days. This is Trump talking with Nora O'Donnell this week on CBS News, a launch of some attacks against Hillary Clinton.
And, you know, when she raises this money, every time she raises money, she's making deals. They're saying, could I be the ambassador to this? Could I do that? Make sure my business is taken care of. I mean, give me a break. All of the money she's raising, that's blood money. That's blood money. Look, she's getting tremendous amounts of money from Wall Street. She's going to take care of Wall Street. She's getting tremendous amounts of money from lots of people. She's going to take care of all those people.
Okay, what do you think of that attack line, Dennis Goldford?
Well, it's typically Trump. To call it blood money is hyperbole. And, of course, he speaks in hyperbole. Unbelievable, amazing, beautiful, all these particular things, the way he talks. But, you know, there's a Republican theme that's gone along for 25 years, which is that there's something fundamentally untrustworthy about Hillary Clinton. It's one of her big vulnerabilities. And she's got to find a way to deal with that. So Trump, you know, was very effective, as you noted, in the primaries, even without a lot of money, in putting a particular label or brand, if you will, on his opponents and making it stick. So that's why he keeps talking about crooked Hillary. So, you know, he's going to argue and push this untrustworthy theme. And, you know, she's going to just argue that he's dangerous. And that's going to be the major theme there.
Well, let's expand on that. Dennis, leading right into this bit of audio from Hillary Clinton speaking at a rally in Ohio yesterday.
Just like he shouldn't have his finger on the button, he shouldn't have his hands on our economy. Now, I don't say that because of typical political disagreements. Liberals and conservatives say Trump's ideas would be disastrous. The Chamber of Commerce and labor unions, Mitt Romney and Elizabeth Warren, economists on the right and the left and the center all agree Trump would throw us back into recession.
Okay, Dave Anderson, will that sink in, especially to independent voters, that sort of argument that Trump has also his own party, part of it, against him?
Well, we'll see. I think traditional political playbooks would say, yes, what Hillary is doing is smart. She's hitting him hard, but she's hitting him on substance, and that is going to kind of work its way into the minds of independent voters. And I think most traditional playbooks say she's winning this at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But Trump has a new playbook. He has a totally new playbook. He is not campaigning like anybody has really campaigned, at least not at this level, for a very long time. And his hope is that voters kind of don't get into the substantive issues, and that his rhetoric just kind of carries the day continually.
Right. And fact-checking, though, is important here because we see all politicians stretch the truth. We know this, but it's a matter of degree. PolitiFact, evaluating Donald Trump's assertions up to this point, gives him, I think, 74-75% untruths that come out of his mouth. Three-quarters of his things that he's been saying on the stump do not match up with reality by the nonpartisan PolitiFact there.
The problem is that facts have become politicized. We used to oppose facts to political opinions, and now people tend to see all facts as themselves politically not just motivated, but political in character. And the irony is this began on the left with postmodernism, arguing there really isn't an objective reality and a set of objective facts. And this has migrated to the right. You remember Karl Rove's comments a couple of cycles ago about how reporters lived in what he called the reality-based community. And he said, you know, we create political facts, he argued. And I think the closest we've seen to Trump, although to some extent he's the spawn of Sarah Palin, is George Wallace from 1968, because Wallace talked about those pointy-headed intellectuals in Washington and the bureaucrats who couldn't park a bicycle straight. And when we've had the awful circumstances we've had with the 2008 recession and the follow-up with the war against terrorism and all that, you know, the knowledge-based community, so to speak, hasn't acquitted itself very well in solving these problems in the view of a lot of people who felt left behind. And there's a lot of resentment there.
Okay, let's listen to this. We talk about lack of facts or innuendo. Donald Trump is very good at this.
Absolutely.
Here is Donald Trump speaking this week about Hillary Clinton to a group of Christian leaders in New York yesterday. Listen to the wording here.
Anything about Hillary in terms of religion? Now, she's been in the public eye for years and years, and yet there's nothing out there. There's like nothing out there. It's going to be an extension of Obama, but it's going to be worse, because with Obama, you had your guard up. With Hillary, you don't. And it's going to be worse.
Okay, talking about religion, there's nothing out there, he's saying, of Hillary Clinton, which we can point to many, many religious events that Hillary Clinton has been part of, Dave Anderson. What is Trump doing here, Dave?
Well, this is kind of a beautiful technique of persuasion. You rely on the fact that most people don't know what Hillary Clinton does on a daily basis, so you insinuate something, and the people who will kind of want to believe you will just assume it's true. The people who might not want to believe you will assume it's false. And there are very few people in the middle. Not many people will hear that statement and immediately jump on Google and say, how religious is Hillary Clinton? So it allows your supporters to just believe that what you're asserting is true. And hopefully it allows you to amass a whole series of people who kind of get together behind this theme of crooked Hillary.
Last time I read the Article 6 of the Constitution, there was a prohibition on a religious test for office. So, you know, introducing this matter again is playing fast and loose with our constitutional qualifications, even though Americans are always concerned about the issue of religion.
If you're speaking to a group of evangelical leaders, though,
it does hit home,
and we don't look to the Constitution.
And that's the core Republican constituency. You know, that's what Ted Cruz was betting his campaign on. It's just Trump stole his thunder in that regard. That's a core Republican constituency, and there are very mixed feelings about Trump in that constituency. Republicans can't win with conservative Christians, conservative evangelicals alone, but they absolutely cannot win without them.
Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Dave Anderson with us of Iowa State University, coming to the end of our Politics Wednesday. Always a lot to chew over, except especially as we count down the weeks. We have a few months, many weeks to go before the general election in November. Let's talk about some other political happenings within the last few days. Monday, Donald Trump firing Corey Lewandowski, his campaign manager who helped him win the Republican nominating contests. Trump saying that Lewandowski did a great job, and it's time now for a different kind of campaign. Dave, what is this signal in, from what you can gather, in a change for the Trump campaign?
Sure. I think this is probably the biggest development in the Trump campaign since he won the nomination. Corey Lewandowski did a really fantastic job of helping Trump win the primary. But a general election is a totally different ballgame. In a primary, you can largely pick up, especially when you have a small campaign, you can pick up your campaign and move state to state. And Trump kind of ran a concert tour. He ran big rallies, and that was successful. Some of the weaknesses we saw in the primary was that Trump did not have a very good get-out-the-vote organization. He was still able to win the primaries, though. When you move to the general election, you have to put together a national apparatus. You have to have headquarters in every state. You have to have a plan to get your voters to the polls on that specific day. And you need to know how to build that kind of institution. Corey Lewandowski just didn't have that experience. He was apparently a rather caustic personality as well, and people had a tough time getting along with him. So bringing in Paul Manafort to kind of be the new campaign manager may fundamentally transform how Trump is campaigning for office. I'm really interested to see what he develops into as a candidate.
We're hearing Lewandowski, also a big backer of Let Trump Be Trump on the campaign trail. Does that, Dennis, in your eyes, mean that we dial that back?
Well, we always heard about years ago a new Nixon. The question is, can there be a new Trump? I mean, you get what you get with Trump. Is he going to change his spots? It's hard to see how that would be the case when he's actually given speeches using a written text and a teleprompter. One of the interesting reasons why people watched him on cable TV, especially during the primary season, was it's the sort of that thrill, that thought that any moment this guy rhetorically is going to set himself on fire. And that was attractive to an audience. And at the same time, when he's given these speeches using a text and a teleprompter, it's a good sleep inducement. He's just not himself. So can he bend himself to that? That's the big question. He seems to function best and most spontaneously when he attacks.
Let's look at, have you comment on the latest polls in swing states? Iowa among them, swing states, about 11 of them likely to decide who will reside in the White House in the next term. Donald Trump slipping farther behind Hillary Clinton in Florida, losing a narrow advantage in Ohio, two of the biggest swing states, and remaining in a dead heat in Pennsylvania. This is a Quinnipiac University poll gauging voter attitudes in those three swing states out yesterday. Dave, what have you been seeing in the polls?
Well, Hillary Clinton is getting a stronger and stronger lead, but it is, again, very, very early. At this point in 2012, I believe Barack Obama had a similar lead over Mitt Romney, and that clearly tightened as the months went on. So it's really too early to say what's going to happen. I think we're still in for a rather close election. Mm-hmm. The fact is that there are very few undecided voters in this country. The Republican base is probably going to go out and vote for Trump, and the Democratic base is going to go out and vote for Hillary. And
What about Trump's claim, though, that he will rewrite the electoral map, putting states into play that are normally safe for Democrats?
It's possible. We're still waiting to see evidence of it.
That's the big question. There are 17 states plus D.C., Washington, D.C., that have voted for the Democratic presidential nominee in every one of the last six presidential elections. They total currently 242 electoral votes. If Hillary Clinton were to hold those, and they include places like Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, all she'd need to win is Florida with 29 electoral votes. That would give her 271. North Carolina, Ohio, places like that wouldn't matter. That's why when Trump talks that way, he's talking about trying to go prospecting among his supporters and increase that in places like Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin, states that have been consistently and reliably Democratic. When he talks about new voters coming out to support him, Dave, I don't think I've seen any evidence that there really has been the case. And if anybody new comes out in Texas or Alabama, it doesn't matter because those are going to go Republican anyway.
Mm. Absolutely true. Trump has a great ability to convince people that he's bringing out droves and droves of new supporters. But there's very little evidence of this. We're still waiting to see it happen.
He's a salesman.
And a wonderful salesman at
yes.
that.
Let me sell you this item before we end the hour that's in our news. Have you comment on it at least? This week, U.S. Representative Steve King, representing Iowa's 4th District, introduced an amendment in Congress that would prevent Harriet Tubman, the abolitionist and supporter of women's suffrage, from replacing Andrew Jackson, the president, on the $20 bill. Last night, however, the House Rules Committee agreed to deny consideration of that proposal. That would have prevented the Treasury Department from spending money to redesign currency or coins. King said, rationalizing this, giving his reasons, in his words, it's not about Harriet Tubman. It's about keeping the picture on the $20 bill. Why would you want to change that? I am a conservative. I like to keep what we have. Politico quoted King as saying it is racist and sexist to say a woman or person of color should be added to the currency. Here's the explanation for that. Here's what's really happening, says King. This is liberal activism on the part of the president that's trying to identify people by categories, and he's divided us into lines of groups. This is a divisive proposal on the part of the president, and it's my view, just don't change anything. Dave Loebsack here, just handed to me by Dean Borg on Steve King's amendment to block Harriet Tubman from the $20 bill. Steve King and his history of racist and sexist comments is an embarrassment to Iowa. So Dave Loebsack weighing in on this comment before we end the hour. We have a minute or two left. Dennis Goldford.
Steve King engages much more in a kind of symbolic politics or a politics of symbolism rather than sort of concrete material legislative achievements. And he marches to his own drummer, beat of his own drummer. His constituents are quite happy to walk behind him. But it's ironic that when for somebody who really is more interested in the importance of political symbolism, he denies the other side the right to engage in symbolism as well.
Mm-hmm. Dave, your thoughts?
I think this is Steve King being Steve King. He's rallying the troops. He's throwing red meat to the crowd. But it didn't really amount to much.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on his challenger come November? Is he in danger of losing a seat? We're talking about the Democrats even possibly getting back the U.S. House.
I think Steve King is in a very safe district. It would take a lot more than this right now to really challenge him, I think.
Mm-hmm. Today we heard Florida Senator Marco Rubio, former presidential candidate, dubbed Little Marco by Trump, announced he will seek re-election to the Senate, a boost for Republicans in that fight. Dennis, the last word to you. What's your view on the Democrats recapturing the Senate?
I think they've got a reasonable chance if they get their turnout. It's always the problem for Democrats, turnout.
Okay. I want to thank you very much. Dennis Goldford, Chair, Professor of Political Science at Drake University, also Flansburg Fellow at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement. Dennis, thanks for coming in.
Always a pleasure.
Dave Anderson, Assistant Professor of Political Science, Iowa State University. Thank you, Dave, for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, with help from Lauren Knutson. Tomorrow on this program, we'll listen back to a conversation I had with two astrophysicists and a former NASA astronaut about Mars. Is there life out there? Tune in tomorrow. We'll listen back to that conversation. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.